Let's begin with scripture. In the beginning was the Word. Wait, no, that's not quite right. Let me start again. In the beginning was the metaphor of the Word, and the Word wasn't even a word at all, not like the ones I'm speaking now. Start again. In the beginning was the metaphor of the Word, and the Word meant communication. But people quickly forgot that communication is something that people do with words, or that animals do with cries or yelps, or so-called body language, or even that microbes and cells do by broadcasting chemicals to one another. 1948 was the year people forgot what words really mean, that words really mean. Norbert Wiener's cybernetics and Claude Shannon's mathematical theory of communication concluded that pretty much everything was information, but the messages they were theorizing weren't limited to humans at all. They were the messages forwarded between machines, not semantics or pragmatics, but pure syntax. That is, how signs relate to other signs, the new information, or perhaps what we today might call code. Norbert Wiener renominated cybernetics that year as a general theory of command, control, and communication, one that did not differentiate between life and machines. Or as he wrote, qualitative differences between organisms and machines have not appeared so far. Of course, this was a pronouncement that depended on what differences make a difference, to paraphrase fellow cybernetician and anthropologist Gregory Bateson. Humans were, at best, what Warren McCullough termed machines that want, self-perpetuating circuits, homeostats, feedback loops, and servo mechanisms, bits of Boolean logic. The mid-century collapse of life onto code comes as no surprise. Other thinkers had been inching toward it for centuries. Who here remembers Kant or automatons? But by the decade's close, the analogy had sunk into generalized common sense, unquestioned, unquestionable, unspeakable. So much so that, as the protein paradigm came to a close and DNA became the molecule of the day in 1953, cybernetic metaphors ported from information theory into molecular biology. Human heredity was understood as a scion of information theory. By the 1960s, the DNA code was a cryptanalytic cipher to be cracked, and molecular biologists readily described hereditary molecules, hormones, cells, and nervous systems as text, programs, information, and messages. But pause momentarily and try to erase the last 60 years from your memory. See, I just used another informatic metaphor. You just can't stop it. The notion that DNA and RNA are, as molecular biologist Francois Jacob described, the memory of a computer is not only non-obvious, but also astonishing. Yet, this is the trope we have inherited from the militarized academy of the Cold War, and it remains a lively metaphor to this day, shaping biomolecular research and bioengineering design. I will skim over what happens next. The DNA code was cracked, the role of messenger RNA was elucidated, and the development of recombinant DNA technology spurred biotech in the 1980s. The body became analogous to computerized missile guidance, a long series of ones and twos, flips and flops, yes or no, and or. Fast forward now to 2012. A synthetic biologist asks me, what's the difference between a virus and a computer program? I felt no need to answer. The question was rhetorical, and the rhetoric is, viruses are computer programs. Still, my memory unspooled the conditions that made such a question possible. John von Neumann, yes, that John von Neumann's, insistence that bacteriophages were machines. Biologist Peter Medawar's mid-century definition of a virus as a piece of bad news wrapped in protein. In the last years of the 20th century, emigres from electrical engineering and computer science made a resolution. If the aim of biology was to understand life, then manufacturing new life would yield better theories than would experimentation. They advocated not experiment, but manufacture, not reduction, but construction, not analysis, but synthesis. New biotechnology techniques, notably faster and cheaper DNA sequencing and synthesis, aided them in their efforts. And by sequencing and synthesis, I of course mean the ability to read strings of genetic nucleotides, adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine from physical molecules, and then also doing the reverse, making physical DNA to order according to a specified sequence. In short, life went digital. Just as genetic synthesis and sequencing are paired technologies that drive synthetic biology, synthesis and analysis are joined philosophical modes of reasoning underwritten by these technologies. Making stuff, synthesis, has become a mode of analysis, a way of theorizing the biological. What theories then are forwarded by such newly designed life forms? In addition to techniques and practices borrowed from their home disciplines, synthetic biologists carried with them a rich trove of analogies and metaphors that directed their thinking about how to manufacture life. As physical computers, software code, computational logic gates, digital circuits, and cybernetic information. One synthetic biologist's favorite catchphrase was, and this is a quote, "The genetic code is 3.5 billion years old. It's time for a rewrite." Such informatic thinking infected not just how synthetic biologists theorized organisms, but also how they designed and made them. The earlier question, what's the difference between a virus and a computer program, was posed to me by synthetic biologist Drew Endy. This was the first symptom of an ongoing infection. At the time, synthetic biologists had just launched the so-called T7.1 project. The protagonist of this strange tale is a simple bacteriophage virus named T7, a creature so minimal it is arguably only marginally alive. It first snuck into the lab in a Trojan horse, a parasite hidden within bacterial cultures, that is, a parasite of a parasite. It was soon discovered and used as an experimental object between 1944 and 1948. Biologists have described this infectious agent as so austere that it is pseudo-living, as existing on the very edge of life. Yet the virus wasn't as simple as it at first seemed. Back in the mid-1990s, Endy aimed to build a software simulation that would predict the model, the behavior of the T7 virus. Building such a computational model on this reasoning would effectively verify the sum total of all the data molecular biologists had gathered about the phage during its long tenure in research laboratories. All they needed to do was computationally model the two things this virus can do. And that is, once the bacteriophage infects a bacterium, it can either remain burrowed within the genetic material of that bacteria, which is called lysogeny, or it can replicate itself, burst through the cell's walls, and infect more bacteria, a phase called lysis. So on, off, yes, no, and, or. The computational model was an abject failure, incapable of predicting the behavior of T7. Here is where the engineer's penchant for synthesis meets biological analysis. By this logic, the computational simulation's failure was nothing less than a failure of experimental discovery-based biology. All the knowledge that had been painstakingly gathered by geneticists, molecular biologists, and virologists over the course of 60 years of laboratory experimentation was simply not enough. Not enough to predict the behavior of an organism so simple it is only arguably marginally alive. For synthetic biologists, the virus was then disorganized, cluttered with genetic noise. Junk DNA was assumed to be the accumulated detritus of evolution. Every obsolete bit and bob of every preceding organism, every strange cul-de-sac on the wandering path toward fitness, every scar of infection piled up, stuffed in, and overflowing the genetic code. Such thinking of genomes as massive, incomprehensible, and buggy molecular ciphers triggered these computer scientists come biologists' enthusiasm for debugging software. Because life resisted their best efforts to simulate, model, predict, or understand it, life must be, in short, bad code. So they set about reprogramming it. The infection spread. Upon his arrival at MIT, ND tasked two of his grad students with rebuilding the genetic material of the virus itself, in hopes of manufacturing a virus simple enough that it could accord with computational models. Let me repeat what I just said. Because the simulation didn't work, they decided not to scrap the model, but to radically modify the virus itself. The very fact that these researchers chose to rebuild the physical virus to conform to a digital model, and not vice versa, demonstrates the extent to which biological inquiry remains under the sway of information theory. Unable to understand how a life form works, they remade it in order to make it easier to understand. And so the two grad students set about redesigning the viral genome. Their first step was to take the entire genome and separate overlapping genes that coded for separate proteins so that the genes could be manipulated independently of one another. You will never have to know anything that is happening on this slide. But a well-designed genetic code, they reasoned, must be modular. So once they had separated out overlapping elements, they successively deleted those genes with no known function, aiming to generate a virus bearing only the minimal number of genes necessary for it to be viable. They successfully removed 35 out of 60. By 2005, these students had, borrowing the terminology of computer scientists, refactored and rebooted the T7.1 virus, which they named following programming nomenclature. But follow me now into their laboratory to peer at what sort of creature they had brought into existence. Here are four petri dishes. On the left, an unengineered or wild-type virus flourishes in bacterial cultures. On the right, the engineered T7.1 virus has infected the same bacteria. Notice that the bacterial plaques bearing the re-engineered virus are puny and sparse. Simply, T7.1 is much worse than its naturally occurring predecessor at doing precisely what this virus has evolved to do: infect bacteria, replicate itself, burst its host, repeat. If natural selection is the gradual modification of an organism to be suited to its environment, by what logic could a better genome encode a defective virus? Synthetic biologists, as engineers bending computational principles to living form, build living systems that are more suited to human understanding. As biological making converges with biological knowing, as techne joins episteme, a well-designed organism is one that is optimized for human understanding, and most evolved organisms don't pass the comprehensibility test. So, turning the earlier equation life equals information inside out, life in the 21st century became information's opposite. Not signal, not information, but entropy and noise. And T7 was demonstrative of that fact. It was more noise than signal, more complexity than simplicity, more randomness than design. They need, synthetic biologists claim, to be recoded, refactored, and salvaged. Viruses need to be rescued from their own proliferating misinformation. When making new biological things becomes the path by which biology is best understood, then understandable biological things get preferentially made. Exegesis becomes a selective evolutionary force. I further posit that such active interested making is not limited to the case I here examine, but rather is endemic to the natural sciences of our time. I call these objects of synthetic biology persuasive objects. By this I mean that such living things do not simply exemplify what life is or what it may next become. Rather, life wrought in an informatic idiom materializes theories of what synthetic biologists seek to understand about life. In short, the features, theories, and limits that they facet upon are circularly determined by their own experimental tactics, which they then identify with the things that they have made. If we began in 1948 with the discursive collapse of life onto computing, by 2018, life is being built to materialize Wiener and Neumann's proclamations that life is informatic. Bits of living persuasion, therefore, function synecdochically. They are vital manifestations of digital theories that simultaneously convince and compel biologists to redefine.